This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Parliament approves a law that bans and criminalizes any attempts to normalize relations with Israel. President Vladimir Putin says Russia is ready to help alleviate the deepening global food crisis if the West lifts its sanctions against Moscow. Also ahead, gun control activists and lawmakers rally outside the US Capitol to call for action after a mass shooting left 19 school kids and two teachers dead in Texas. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Iraqi Parliament has unanimously approved legislation that criminalizes any forms of normalizing ties with Israel. Parliament said in a statement that the law represents a true reflection of the will of the Iraqi people. The legislative body urged Arab and Islamic parliaments to follow suit. The bill requires all officials, including those in the semi-autonomous Kurdish region, institutions and the media, to refrain from establishing relations with the Israeli regime. The United Arab Emirates, Sudan, Bahrain and Morocco have established diplomatic ties with Israel. Despite backlash from much of the Arab world, the Palestinians condemn the move as a betrayal of their cause and a stab in their back. Political commentator Faraz al-Najm says the Iraqi parliament's legislation to ban normalization of ties with Israel is a turning point which can inspire other countries to follow the same approach.
Is a little bit different than the way it was going a few months ago, where regimes were jumping on board to normalize and become closer to the Zionist occupiers of Palestine. This is a very new ignition, and it's a new change in the Middle East, and I think this will open the doors for other governments in the region. I've already heard recently that Algeria is also very much inspired now and willing to do the same thing inside Algeria, and they're speaking about it. So you have people that are going towards supporting Israel, and there's ones that are going now towards supporting Palestine. So this major development is actually a very good change, and it actually also speaks for the nations. I mean, the nation's will and the determination of the nation has a big role in this.
Iran strongly condemns the new sanctions announced by the U.S. Treasury Department against several Iranian nationals and entities. The foreign ministry spokesman said the Iran's armed forces, especially the Quds Force, have always been a nightmare for terrorist groups in the region. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the United States is, quote, the godmother of these terrorist groups and spares no efforts in supporting them. Khatibzadeh underlined that the Biden administration is continuing its predecessor's failed maximum pressure policy. He said the new sanctions are another sign of the U.S. government's ill will towards Iran. On Wednesday, the White House announced new sanctions on some Iranian individuals and entities, citing their links to the IRGC, which is blacklisted by Washington. Political commentator David Iroubian says Iran has no reason to rely on the goodwill of the United States because Washington's foreign policy is based on expanding its hegemony.
Well, unfortunately, it's not a joke. It's the reality of the American position regarding Iran, unfortunately, going back to 1979. And so I believe that most observers of the JCPOA process of Iran-U.S. relations are aware that there is absolutely no goodwill between Iran and the United States, nor is there any reason, especially for Iran, to look for or to consider American actions to be based on American goodwill. The United States foreign policy is completely designed around the full spectrum dominance global hegemony framework of Paul Wolfowitz, and as well strongly guided, of course, by the interests of the apartheid state of Israel and the despotic kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the region. Therefore, there is no goodwill. There will not be any goodwill.
Iranians have attended a funeral service in the capital Tehran to honor the assassinated IRGC Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodayi. Our correspondent Gisu Ahmadi has attended the ceremony and filed this report.
Iranians flocked to a mosque downtown Tehran to pay their respects to the colonel that was fatally shot earlier this week. The attack on Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodayi, which claimed his life, happened in Tehran on Sunday when two motorcyclists shot him five times while he was in his car and fled the scene.
This assassination simply shows the desperation of Israel and the fact that those behind the attack have reached a point where they can only resort to such brutal attacks in order to discourage us. What they don't know is that martyrdom is considered an honor and strengthens our resolve, and of course such act will not remain unanswered.
The assassination bears the hallmarks of previous deadly shootings in Iran for which Israel has taken responsibility for. But so far, there have been no such official claims. However, the New York Times on Wednesday quoted an Israeli intelligence official saying that Tel Aviv has informed American officials that it was behind the attack.
This is a known policy of our enemies and it is nothing new. State-sponsored terrorism is a basis of their doctrine. Every time they fail, this is what they do. They resort to assassination plots.
The Islamic Republic has been a victim of terrorist attacks since it was established over four decades ago. The last such attack happened in November 2020 when an Iranian scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated.
As you can see, people from all walks of life have come here to attend the ceremony. The message is clear.
Senior Iranian officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi, have condemned the attack in the strongest terms, and Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN has also urged the international community to firmly react to the brutal assassination of the IRGC colonel, who played a significant role in the fight against Daesh and other terrorists in the region.
Those taking part in this funeral ceremony share the same opinion. They all say that every drop of blood gives birth to 100 like-minded people. People who will be walking down the same path as martyr Sayyad Khodayi. You kill one, he becomes 100. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Elsewhere, the UN Special Rapporteur, in his visit to Afghanistan, has warned about humanitarian and economic crises in the country. Richard Bennett has called on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support to Afghanistan in order to protect the Afghan people in the face of sanctions on the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for an investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected, and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turning elsewhere now, Russian forces have come closer to surrounding Ukrainian troops in two eastern cities as they try to expand their control over the Donbass region. The Russians have been attacking from three sides to encircle the Ukrainians in the cities of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk. That's according to Ukrainian officials. They say Russian forces reached the last highway out of the cities and even set up a checkpoint, but it was later broken. The officials say the Russian army does not control the route now, but they are shelling it. If those two cities were to fall, Russia would gain control over the Donbass region, or the Donbass province, pardon me, of Luhansk. Over the past few weeks, Russia has focused its fighting in the industrial eastern Donbass region, where Moscow-backed pro-independence fighters are stationed. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is pursuing a policy of genocide in Donbass. Russia, meanwhile, is ready to help tackle a growing food crisis if the West lifts its sanctions against the country. That's what Russian President Vladimir Putin told Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi. The two spoke on the phone on Thursday. According to the Kremlin, Putin said Russia is ready to export grain and fertilizer to help overcome the crisis. The United States was quick to react, accusing Russia of weaponizing food and economic assistance. Russia and Ukraine produce 30% of the world's wheat supply. The war in Ukraine, coupled with Western sanctions on Russia, has disrupted supplies of fertilizer, wheat, and other commodities from both countries. The West blames Russia for the food supply's problems, accusing it of closing Ukrainian ports. Russia says the accusation is unfounded, and Ukraine itself has closed its ports to place mines. U.S. police are under scrutiny for their late response to a school shooting that killed 19 elementary students and two adults in the state of Texas on Tuesday. A video circulating online shows families of the students urging officers to take action while standing outside the school. Local media say police waited outside for at least 40 minutes before confronting the gunman. The shooting took place in the city of Uvalde. Earlier, authorities held a press briefing praising police for their quick response to the massacre. Families of the victims dismissed that. Meanwhile, activists have gathered outside the U.S. Capitol calling for action to control gun violence.
We do this because we love our children.
Yes.
I'm here because I'm scared it's going to be me next. I don't know who's next. Me, my friends, my peers, and nothing's being changed. I'm a 17-year-old girl in high school, and something needs to be changed, and there needs to be laws in place.
I'm a grandma. I'm against guns. That's all. Gag. It makes me gag every time this happens, and it happens all the time.
Always.
2 times in the last 12 days.
The second go-round.
How much more can we put up with this stuff?
The activists called for more restrictions on people legally acquiring guns. Some also proposed prohibiting gun purchases by people under the age of 21. They argued that such a rule could have prevented the 18-year-old shooter in Texas from acquiring weapons. The U.S. has seen several mass shootings this month. Almost 2 weeks ago, a gunman opened fire at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York. 10 people were killed and 3 wounded. 11 of the victims were African American. That report brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Martyrdom of Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartfelt condolences to you all on a very doleful day. Today, the 25th of Shawwal, renews our grief, since it was on this day Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, the sixth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was forced to depart from the mortal world because of a dose of fatal poisoning by the tyrant Mansur Davanighi, who styled himself as the second caliph of the usurper Abbasid regime. Please stay with us for an exclusive feature in this regard. We have figured everything in a manifest imam. These are the words of God Almighty in Ayah 12 of Surah Yasin of the Noble Quran. These divine words are worth pondering upon. They refer to a group of extraordinary persons of the human race whom the one and only Creator, after having tested their souls before creation, has entrusted them in authority. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as the best of creation, is most supreme example of this group, followed by his divinely designated vicegerent, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Next are the leaders of the youth of paradise, Imam Hassan Mujtaba and martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon them. The other members of this elite group are the nine infallible descendants of the martyr of Karbala, culminating in the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance for establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. It is incumbent upon humanity to follow the guidelines of these paragons par excellence in order to achieve success in life and salvation in afterlife. Thus, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, whose martyrdom we commemorate today, was indeed among the manifest Imams in whom God Almighty has figured everything, as Ayah 12 of Surah Yasin testifies. Those still in doubt about the unsurpassed God-given merits, knowledge, and wisdom of the Prophet and the Imams of his infallible Ahlul Bayt are invited to study the life of Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. Born in 83 AH to Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, he spent the first 12 years of his life under the guidance of his grandfather, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala. History bears witness that while only a boy of less than 10 years, Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, used to frequent the classes of his grandfather and father, and to the surprise of the students, which included gray-bearded scholars and were far older in age than him, he used to discuss serious matters of jurisprudence, theology, and other sciences. In one such discourse, when he was only 11 years old, he entered a class of students and scholars discussing the subject of astronomy, and to the surprise of everyone, except his own father, he explained to the gathering, "The earth cannot be flat, because of the way the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and in view of the fact that the day and the night cyclically follow each other, completing a 24-hour day. This means," said the young, beardless, preteen boy, "the earth is round, otherwise this would not have happened in such a precise manner." All the scholars and students gasped in surprise and acclamation, while Imam Baqir, peace upon him, smiled in appreciation of God-given knowledge of his young son. For the information of our listeners, this incident is not just confined to the sacred text of the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, but has been mentioned in a book compiled by five French scholars at Strasbourg, France, titled The Heart of Shia Scholarship. Written originally in French, the book has been translated into English, Arabic, Persian, Urdu, and other languages with authoritative references. Today, we are living in an age of injustice and hypocrisy, despite mankind's achievements in science and civilization. The modern world is embroiled in the most macabre form of cannibalistic terrorism by the godless takfiris who masquerade as Muslims in order to tarnish the image of Islam on the orders of their heretical Wahhabi creators. The devilish Zionists and the satanic powers such as the US, which misuse science and technology to build dangerous atomic arsenals. The situation warrants us to focus on the genuine teachings of Islam, as bequeathed to us by the Prophet through his immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Of this elite group, it was Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, who, during his 34-year mission, had the opportunity to revive for the benefit of humanity the genuine Sunnah and Sirah,
or the practice and behavior of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, at whose feet some 4,000 scholars used to assemble at his famous Academy of Medina to learn different branches of knowledge and wisdom, including natural sciences like physics, chemistry, astronomy, and the like, in addition to hadith, exegesis of the Noble Quran, jurisprudence, theology, etc., lived in a crucial era when the tyrannical Umayyad regime was on the way out and the equally oppressive Abbasid regime was seizing power. As a result, the sixth Imam, though subjected to intermittent bouts of imprisonment by the Umayyad Hisham ibn Abdul Malik and the Abbasid Mansur Dawaniqi, had the time to teach the seekers of facts and realities that the earth is spherical. It revolves around the sun. The air contains oxygen. The water has hydrogen and mysteries of the rays of light. Besides expounding to them the proper cognizance of Almighty Allah, the concept of divine justice and correct manner of prayer and supplication, and the wisdom of reward and punishment on the day of resurrection. At the same time, he advised those in political authority to cater to the needs of the people. Be kind to the masses. Do not oppress them. Behave in good manner. Desist from embezzlement and stealing from the public treasury, and to avoid listening to mischief mongers whose main intention is to wreck the life of others. A vivid example in this regard is the sixth Imam's letter to Abdullah al-Najashi, who was the governor of Ahvaz and Fars in southwestern and southern Iran. The letter given to a person who lacked the means to pay the heavy taxes levied by the regime read, "In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, behave leniently towards your brother. May Allah be lenient with you too." When Najashi took the letter, he kissed it, read it, and not only exempted the bearer from paying the heavy tax of 10,000 dirhams, but granted him several other facilities. These and other examples of public welfare, coupled with the imparting of the genuine teachings of Islam, as well as grooming in science and technology, one of whose exemplary products was Jabir ibn Hayyan, the father of chemistry, were viewed with horror by Mansur Dawaniqi, who knew that the rightful successor of the Prophet was Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. And once people became aware of this reality, will we most surely turn away from the Abbasid. He also knew how the Abbasid propagandists had received the Muslim masses by raising the slogan of restoration of the rights of the Ahlul Bayt during the campaign to overthrow the Umayyads. Although Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, had no intention of taking over the political rule of the Islamic realm, he had, without opening it, burned the letter of offer of caliphate by the general Abu Salame al-Khalal. Since the imamat is God-given authority and it is divine will that only the 12th and last infallible imam will rise as Qa'im al-Mahdi in the end times to establish the global government of justice, The Abbasids were frightened, and Mansur left no stone unturned to undermine Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, including the futile bid to use pseudo-scholars such as Abu Hanifa to debate with the rightful Imam, in whom God has enshrined all knowledge. Mansur remembered his days as an obscure, persecuted member of the larger Bani Hashim clan, whose prime member was Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, in those days of persecution of the Prophet's family. He was aware of his own insignificant presence at the famous gathering at Abwa in 120 AH, where he had acknowledged Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, as the Prophet's rightful successor, and given pledge of political allegiance to the Hassanid branch of the Prophet's family as future rulers after the Umayyads. In 132 AH, the Abbasids seized the caliphate by deceiving the masses. In 136, Mansur succeeded his brother Abbas as-Safa as caliph and immediately started imprisoning, torturing, and martyring the descendants of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. Nafs Zakiye was martyred in 142 AH, and his brother Ibrahim was martyred the next year. Mansur had the roof of the prison collapsed on other members of the Hassanid clan and buried them alive under the debris while building his new capital, Baghdad. Finally, in 148 AH, the dastardly Mansur had Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, martyred through a fatal dose of poison. He thought he could blot out genuine Islam, but failed, as is clear from the prevalence of Fiqh al-Ja'fari, or the school of jurisprudence of the Ahl al-Bayt, which is indeed the pure, pristine, and dynamic Sharia of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
The results of the Lebanese parliamentary elections reflect changes in the country's political map. Three indicators are being monitored a week after the final count of these results. The first relates to the international position amid confusion about whether Lebanon is waiting for a new initiative led by France or whether it will be left alone in the face of the economic crisis accompanying a political debate that is expected to expand in light of a Saudi intervention that pushes some hot-headed people to continue the political battle against Hezbollah. The second indicator is related to the constitutional entitlement related to the election of the Speaker of Parliament amid a wave of pressure aimed at boycotting the vote for Speaker Nabih Birri and isolating the most prominent and possibly only Shia candidate by electing him with votes that are much less than half the number of deputies. The third indicator is a determined attempt by groups speaking in the name of change to enter into a populist revelry based on the idea that the logic that accompanied the October 17 uprisings in Beirut should continue within the parliament, while spreading an exaggerated atmosphere to prevent any opposing discussion between the elected representatives. The elections for the parliament speaker became the main talked-about event in the past week, after parliamentary blocs and representatives of the opposition forces announced their refusal to vote for Nabih Birri, which makes the session a merit that will not pass as smoothly as in past years, especially since the votes that Birri is likely to receive will be the lowest since 1992. It is feared that this new crisis will reflect paralysis in parliament, similar to what was happening in the government formation and the race for presidency. The problem lies in the origin of the session, which needs a quorum of 65, as the election in the first session requires an absolute majority and a relative majority in the second and third session and beyond. Well-informed sources feared that the representatives of October 17, also known as NGO MPs, and the political blocs that refused to elect Birri would boycott the session, which would prevent a quorum, leading the country towards parliamentary paralysis. Simple math guaranteed votes close to 50 from Hezbollah and its allies, and from 9 deputies from the Progressive Socialist Party, also known as Walid Jumlat's bloc, which is likely to give all its votes to Birri, while attention remains on the position of the Free Patriotic Movement, also known as Jobran Basil's bloc, which has not yet been decided. Serious effort has begun, in which Hezbollah is leading, to reach a formula with the Free Patriotic Movement to secure an electoral outcome for Nabih Birri, provided that the movement's share in this settlement would be the position of Deputy Parliament Speaker. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, Ammar Osman. Tension still prevails in the political discourse of winners and losers in the aftermath of the Lebanese parliamentary elections. It is not likely that the duels between all parties will stop in the intervening days of the first session of this new parliament, which will witness the elections of the parliament speaker according to an unresolved conception, unlike what was the case in all previous sessions since 1992. This does not mean that the speaker, Nabih Birri, will not be the candidate for the position, but the position of the elected representatives do not indicate an easy majority, as per the usual, which opens the door early for discussion about the nature of the political fronts that will arise in the post-election stage. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, forming a national unity government has always been the concern of Hezbollah, whether before the elections or afterwards. Between the rejection of the opposition forces and their blackmail of the Free Patriotic Movement, it may be too early to predict the fate of this government, whether it will fail or not, before the winners, the newcomers to the parliament are positioned. They choose their position and their options are pretty well determined. How do you assess the results of the May 15 parliamentary elections in Lebanon in the sense of parliament majority?
The stance of Hezbollah and the resistance bloc inside the parliament, whether in 2018 elections or this latest one, has always been one that calls for a unity government in Lebanon. This stance has always been steady, whatever the election results were, whether in favor of the resistance or not. In the 2018 elections, the resistance bloc had the majority in parliament, and they still called for a unity government. However, the opposing parties had the exact same position they have today, which is a complete refusal to take part in a unity government. Today, after the final results of the 2022 elections were announced, we see that the parliamentary blocs have been divided into several diversified blocs. Despite this, diversification, Hezbollah, Amal, the Free Patriotic Movement, and their allies still outnumber the opposing deputies. I cannot say they have a majority in all internal issues to be voted about in parliament, but there is a new terminology in Lebanon that explains the situation. There will be political agreement as per each case being discussed alone in parliament, case by case. Most probably, this will be the process that will be visible in the Lebanese parliament. Yet, we should keep in mind that the new deputies who emerged to power, who called themselves the independent bloc, added to the Samir Jaja's Lebanese forces, they both raise the same anti-resistance slogans that directly targets the Lebanese resistance, its existence, and its weapons. This team will most probably keep on pushing this political confrontation. The statements issued by these groups since the elections results were out indicate that they refuse to collaborate with any resistance forces to solve the crisis in Lebanon or to meet national merits, on top of which is the elections for the position of parliament speaker.
Well, Mr. Hamza, the parliamentary elections have indeed ended, but the Lebanese and Lebanon has actually entered into a new crisis, maybe open to unknown directions this time. As you just mentioned, that we don't have a majority. It might be by peace, as you just said, but the first of these is not the elections of the speaker of the parliament, nor later on the government, and later after that the presidential race. But beginning with the position of speaker right now, how do you think the cards will be played out, since Nabih Berri might have the least amount of votes since 1992?
Concerning the candidacy of Nabih Berri for the position of parliament speaker, it's nearly confirmed that he will get the necessary votes to win the position. However, the question this time is about the process in which he will gain those votes. As you mentioned, the opposing parties are counting on providing the least number of votes for Nabih Berri, an attempt to serve a blow to the resistance camp in Lebanon. They also want to send a direct message concerning the deputy parliament speaker position by securing a higher percentage of votes to the deputy position than that of speaker position. The deputy is traditionally held by a member of parliament from the Orthodox sect. These are the tactics being discussed today. Jaja's Lebanese forces have their own candidate for the deputy speaker position. So that the Free Patriotic Movement, also the new independent bloc, are yet to get together and choose a candidate. There's a complete package being currently discussed when it comes to parliament speaker elections and his deputy. The high-pitched statements we hear from different political blocs in Lebanon indicate a process of negotiations happening in the country concerning the party which will secure the big deal when it comes to the position of deputy speaker. A deal which constitutes giving Maronite votes to Speaker Berri in return to secure Shia votes from the resistance bloc toward the deputy speaker position.
Well, but it seems that something interesting happened just after the election results were announced, where the head of Hezbollah loyalty to the resistance bloc, Haj Muhammad Ra'ad, who is a member of parliament, again now said about the formation of a national government and the need for the other party to accept it as not to lead Lebanon into the abyss. And his reference to the civil war came to prove that what has been previously proposed since the renewal of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's insistence on a unity government. The opposing parties are openly refusing this. Are we at a violent crossroads for Lebanon? Is this why he mentioned the civil war?
Before we get to the point of predicting a stage of violence in Lebanon, let us be clear that everyone in Lebanon agrees that there are new deputies who have recently arrived to the parliament, who hold new approaches unprecedented in the history of the Lebanese parliament. This new scene was expressed during the electoral campaigns of these new deputies. They hold blatant unseen before positions concerning their readiness to build ties and normalize with the Zionist entity. On the contrary, this same new bloc has a big problem with a main Lebanese political component, that is namely the entire Shia sect and the resistance bloc in Lebanon. They simply want to isolate this sect and remove the armament of its resistance. This is a new political current in Lebanon, that has openly announced its alliance with the Zionist Israeli entity. This is the specific party whom MP Mohammad Raad was referring to when he mentioned possible clashes with what he called the puppets of the Zionist regime. MP Mohammad Raad said that Hezbollah is ready to cooperate with all sorts of opposers, except those who are agents of the Zionist entity in Lebanon. This is a very clear and powerful message from Hezbollah. However, we must keep in mind that the U.S.-sponsored project, which these new MPs are part of, will be part of the ruling process in the Lebanese parliament for the next 4 years. I mean specifically the roles of the U.S. embassy and the Saudi embassy in Beirut, along with whatever projects they represent that does not end with normalizing trends with the Zionist entity. Rather, passes through the millions of dollars they spend to secure the arrival of such deputies to the Lebanese parliament by paying a lot of bribes and excluding the Sunni leader Saad al-Hariri from the political scene to ensure the arrival of Zionist puppets to the parliament under the banner of Jaja's Lebanese forces and a small group of puppets who refer to themselves as the independent bloc. Yes, they did arrive through elections, but Saudis had higher chances in mind than what actually happened. Today, all the anti-resistance groups in Lebanon and the region should sit tight and look closely at the election results. The results do not support the ruling of the pro-Zionist blocs. This means they have to accept to share power with those who outnumbered them, or else the alternative to this is a full-blown confrontation.
It is very interesting to see how the political scene is being shifted in Lebanon with foreign intervention, especially Saudi and U.S. Foreign intervention. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper, for joining us to talk about these very interesting results. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Erdogan's bargaining with NATO in return for a safe zone in Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In the rams between it and the West over the accession of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance, Turkey found that the most appropriate opportunity to bargain with the West and extract concessions from them on another issue involving the safe zone project that it intends to establish in northeastern Syria. Now, Turkey aims to export Syrian refugees residing on its land to resettle in this so-called safe zone. Meanwhile, Kurdish forces have launched a wide media and diplomatic campaign to oppose the Turkish project and prevent its implementation, describing it as a threat to the country in Syria and to the Kurdish presence as a whole. Erdogan's safe zone slash NATO bargain in this following report.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on the NATO members to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria to accommodate refugees and ensure the security of the southern border in return for his country's accession of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance. As soon as Ankara announced its intention to resettle about 1 million Syrian refugees and transfer them from the Turkish interior to the areas it occupies in northern Syria, the Syrian Kurds mobilized against it, considering the project an attempt to change the demographic composition of the city to Afrin and, quote, Arabize it, unquote. The Turkish discourse so far confirms that the project to build alternative residential cities and villages for refugees does not target Afrin alone, but will include also areas in Jarablus, Al-Bab, Idlib, Ras Al-Ain, and Tal al-Abyad. The announcement of the opening of a housing complex with 100 homes in Afrin gave indications about Turkey's undeclared intentions to focus the resettlement plan in this region, where the Kurds constitute the majority of the original population. Erdogan's plan seems like a clear and direct announcement of a deal that Ankara is preparing to ensure field and political gains in exchange for accepting the expansion of NATO and the inclusion of the two countries bordering Russia within NATO. The deal Erdogan is looking for, which he outlined during a meeting with the ruling Justice and Development Party AKP deputies, cannot be considered surprising. It corresponds to Erdogan's continuous efforts to complete the illegal project he launched along the Syrian border more than 3 years ago, with the aim of forming a strip under Turkish control that distances the Kurds from its borders and ensure Turkey's continued control of that region. It is a project that Erdogan has been aiming for since the beginning of the global war on Syria in 2011, when it requested the establishment of a safe zone near its borders, which it was unable to achieve due to many variables, including the Russian position and the Turkish-European and Turkish-American differences, especially after the Kurdish separatists' alliance with Washington in northern Syria and the U.S. military intervention in east of the Euphrates, where the United States occupies Syrian oil regions in the northeast of the country. It seems that the Turkish president, who is facing increasing political pressures against the backdrop of the electoral conflict in his country, in which the issue of Syrian refugees is one of its main axes, is trying during this period to invest all available resources to advance his project, which aims to resettle about 1.5 million refugees out of about 3.5 million by re-exporting them to Syria and resettling them in residential communities along the border strip, which means a process of resettlement and Turkification at the same time.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mrs. Tahseen Al-Halabi, who's a writer, researcher, and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Halabi. Mr. Tahseen, now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on NATO members to support his country's effort to establish what he called a safe zone on the border with Syria to accommodate Syrian refugees for his country's approval of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance. Does he even have the approval of his own parliament before he seeks that of the NATO for a safe zone inside of Syria?
Without any doubt, Erdogan did not receive the approval of his parliament for such a move. I believe a lot of Turkish deputies will oppose such a bargain with NATO. However, it would not be a surprise if Erdogan takes that decision all by himself without going back to the parliament. If so, he will be fully responsible for the consequences of such a decision. On the other hand, building some sort of an entity for refugees on Syrian territory, then by all means, he has no right whatsoever to intervene within 1 inch of Syrian soil. This exploitation and abuse towards the Syrian refugees should be dealt with accordingly by the United Nations. His bargains and proposals with Finland and Sweden should never be accepted at the backdrop of this blatant violation of human rights, international law, and violation of Syrian sovereignty.
Mr. Tahseen, Ankara also announced that it will not agree to the inclusion of Sweden or Finland in NATO, claiming that the two countries harbor terrorists from the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK, while it is demanding the extradition of 12 people from Finland and 21 people from Sweden, in addition to canceling the two countries' decision to ban arms exports to Turkey against the background of its illegal incursion in Syrian territory. Will NATO approve of such a bargain with Erdogan?
I don't believe so, because these states have historic ties with the Kurds in Iraq and the Kurds of Syria. Then the U.S. came along and became included within these ties as well, by using the Kurds in Syria against their own country and nation. Such important issues would not allow Finland and Sweden and the NATO to end their relations with the Kurds, whether in Iraq or Syria. The U.S. now controls the fate of the Kurds, known as SDF, in northeastern Syria. Along with the U.S. is the U.K. and France and Italy and the rest of European countries. They want to keep using the Kurdish issues to pursue their goal of fragmenting Syria and to offend its independence and sovereignty.
Mr. Halabi, Erdogan is trying to invest all available resources that he has and positions to provide a boost to his project, the Safe Zone inside of Syrian territory, which aims to resettle about 1.5 million Syrian refugees by exporting them to Syria and settling them in residential communities in northern Syria with financial support from many parties, namely from Qatar, which includes Turkish schools, Turkish institutions, and hospitals, which means a process of settlement and Turkification. At the same time, do you think this Turkification process will be applicable, knowing that the Syrian government is yet to finalize the northern part of the country militarily?
I believe that all what Erdogan wants to achieve by exploiting the Syrian refugees will not be applicable. Why? First of all, because Syria, with all its resources, will resist and reject such a project with all available means. Turkey is not an external party that had no role in the war on Syria, the invasion, and the violation of Syrian sovereignty. Therefore, Erdogan does not even deserve to play the role of the savior of Syrian refugees by attempting to resettle them inside Syrian territories. On the contrary, Erdogan is at